Perhaps you allow me to go on with this for one little more time. Because in your personal life, you would grasp the necessity of Jesus' date, of his timing, more simply. When you come to the end of a chapter in your life, you will always give it one more final try, and only then give up when you have tested it. This testing, however, seems to be not understood when you read now the Gospel. Take an historical example of a similar type. The French, as you know, in the 18th century, obeyed Louis XV despite all his mistresses and despite all his abuses. But when his very decent son, Louis XVI, proved equally hopeless and helpless, then they made the revolution. As long as the cruel great Herod himself ruled, Israel held his breath. There was still a chance that the successor would break away from this foreign tradition. But his death in 4 BC opened the inheritance. Finality came with the wrong successors in that year. Now royalty definitely was no longer the Davidic royalty. It was a mere fiction. And there was now the demand for a new genuine king. He must come now, and Jesus came. Otherwise, then, Jesus would have come too late. The Gospel stresses the date of the Messiah's coming very consciously. He came when no loyalty any longer was owed in Israel to any other man. On the other hand, Jesus was not given to us a bit too early, because, as you may know, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. So you get 74 years from the death of Herod, 4 BC, to the destruction of the temple. In between, it had all to happen, because in the year 70, the physical vessel of the revelation of Israel vanished from the surface of the earth. To this day, the Jews do not admit this destruction as final, as you know. The wall of wailing is even standing today in the midst of the new state of Zionism in Jerusalem. And still there are Orthodox Jews who wail because of the fall of the city, because they emphasize by their wailing that if the temple has fallen forever, then indeed the revelation has to take a new shape. Therefore, this doesn't can impress you as a great miraculous feat, that the important part of the Gospel is its being embedded between 4 BC and 70 AD. The significance of this embedding lies in its being between a finality of the old law and the physical destruction that followed. Into this gap, Jesus and the apostles stepped. They squeezed themselves into these 74 years, and Jesus constitutes in this time process the first half of the new life, and the apostles constitute the second half. Together, these two generations form one man, this new transferable man who can live from 4 years after Herod to 4 years before the fall of the temple, because Paul and Peter in Rome were probably executed in 65 or 66 of our era. Now, by living as one body or as one man in two generations, they took the whole church, the whole Israel, to every corner of the globe. Well, of this I have now not to speak anymore, but you may now begin to understand why the church has always been called the Apostolic Church. The apostles form the second half of the life of the man Jesus, because when the temple fell, there had to be prepared a unity inside which the new faith, the love, and the hope already had been sunk, and now it could be witnessed. And so this story of the first two generations of Christianity will never be understood as long as you look into the Bible for moral precepts, for doctrine. You must look not for philosophy. Christianity is the very opposite of philosophy of life, because it's only connected with timing. It is constituted as a womb of the times. Our Lord is the Lord of all the eras, where all newborn eons can spring up in reverence. What do we care for the denominations? All this is very minor compared to the one great fact that they entered the world at the decisive hour in freedom and reverence, in bashfulness and in independence. This is what makes all the difference in the world. Because if nothing new had entered there into this gap, the great tradition which now everybody receives into his own life, that mankind is under one God, would have never reached you or me. When to take the truth out of Israel and bring it as a light into the whole of the world, that was a question of great discretion and shame. They had been people, they tried it too early. They weren't patient enough. And they tried it too superficially, just by translating the Bible, for example, into Greek. Obviously, there are people who think today it is too early. Some novel writers I have read on this. And think of all the Orthodox Jews who say that they still wait for the coming of the Messiah. But to be more direct and close to our own day, why do we have so many antichrists? Antichristianity is en vogue, plays on the antichrist abound. Judas Iscariot is hailed. Antichrist, Nietzsche was the antichrist. The liberals believe in philosophy, and so they say, well, what is an antichrist? An antichrist is a man who is as good as Christ in our own day. Why shouldn't they come now, the antichrist? And they abound today because they have denied that Christ's members we become only by seeing that he taught us not doctrine, not wisdom, but timing. And that he started a time process by proving to every one of us when to make the decision, when to become conscious. On his deathbed, in the last minute, he was allowed to say, you said it. And ever since, everybody else has learned to say it with a louder and louder voice. Had he said it himself before, nobody today would mention him. The new Antichrist are, so to speak, the Me Too people, who, looking at his feature and feet, would like to be as much as powerful, as important as he. And to them, Christ becomes a psychopathic exhibitionist. Hence, they have to assume that Jesus was obsessed with a Messiah complex. The tenses of the unfolding of any truth, its phases, are obliterated. The whole story of biblical criticism seems to me to be tainted by this mania of tearing of veils. The gospel, however, has the veil of the temple come off on Good Friday, as it is only now that men come to know in the crucifixion what has been done by them, what has been suffered for them, and what is imparted to them. When the old term revelation, however, 200 years ago, was left standing without its counterpart, the veil, it became a mere relic. Who thinks of revelation today as a necessary element of great truth? The Enlightenment, by tearing off all the veils, has voided all revelations. A shameless universe has no use for veils, as it is neither out to gain time, nor to grow up, nor to come free, nor to change its future directions, nor to time. Hence, in this period of the card index today, shame is listed solely as related to either sex or guilt. Yet one hopeful sign remains alive. Let me mention it to you. There is today still among us a wonderful 18th century ingenue, a robust scion of the obsolete, allegedly obsolete nobility of England. And he especially, it seems to me, in preserving the old tradition of the veil around growth. In his 80th year, Winston Churchill still has kept the sense of wonder over the unfolding of history. Unfolding is the pet word of this rather primitive man in all his books. Now, to look at an unfolding truth means to know how to time. He who respects unfolding expects shame. Church's revelatory instinct, I would like to call it, has stayed the West. It has kept this West sturdy and sound. In this bold statesman, Winston Churchill, churchmen, educators, poets, and all the artists of matchmaking, that is, our young women, may pick their best godfather for bringing up God's creature, shame, in all its glory. We today have no time, no future, no direction, no growth, and no freedom, thanks to the praise of shamelessness and the poo-pooing of shame. When we are men try to find the right moment between too early and too late, they are under the protection of this great creature of which Winston Churchill, so to speak, is the living prophet. The good news can come too early and too late, but it cannot be told all the time to everybody. It has a definite date or day. Easter, it began its public career. If you would consider for one moment what is the most general impact of Christianity on the human race, it would not be baptism, it would not be the Our Father in heaven, it would not be the creed, it would not be the visible church, but it would be the era. It would be the fact that everybody in the world today counts the years after the coming of Christ into the world, because by this fact we are all bowing to the great truth that the important things in life have only one moment in which they really can happen. And the Christian era, therefore, is connected with his coming in order to make this very plain, that Jesus couldn't tell the masses of the Jews. They would have squandered his revelation. He had to put the seed into the ground that had a fence around it, the 12 apostles, the disciples, and only later, when they had even died, could it burst forth and be revealed and made open. And he had to go away before anybody could understand and not trample it down. After all people, when considered outside the timing secret, very much live alike. We all have to eat, we have to breathe, we have to digest, we have to make love, we have to make a living. The only privilege you have is when you do these things. The fast in the church is an attempt to inculcate into your consciousness the fact that the timing, even of when you wish to take food, is yours, and that it makes a difference if you have to eat or if you can forego eating at times. That doesn't alter the fact that you have to eat. And yet, what importance is in the fact that you can forego a good meal, as you are not dependent on it? You can time. And self-knowledge is the highest kind of knowledge because it is filled with the greatest risk of ruining us by too early or too late. It can destroy the growth and the rhythm and the meaning of your life. This is called vital knowledge. But usually people today speak of vital knowledge without including the risk of deadly knowledge. But life is always in the neighborhood of death. And therefore it is so important that you should get accustomed of grading knowledge in this manner. The last vital knowledge can be known all the time. The most vital knowledge can only be known at one vital moment. All other knowledge has to be put between these two extremes. If you like, put it on a blackboard, and then you will see that mathematics and physics give you the most indifferent and the most universal knowledge. It's independent of any moment in time that two and two are said to be four. But that you must go and do this, you can only know at one moment. And at this moment, you also know who you are. And now comes something most people never consider, great truths also must be forgotten again. Because it is so true that timing allows us to know great truths, that obviously, later on, it isn't wise to remember it when we are back again in the slime and in the mud of everyday living. I'll tell you a story on this. A little girl, in fact, my own sister-in-law, was a very beautiful child, and at one time the teacher in school was angered by her vitality and her cheerfulness. And so he said to her, "You will have to write 20 times as a punishment, 'I am a goose.' Repeat. What do you have to do?" She got up and said cheerfully in front of the whole class, "I am a good gift of God, and nobody shall abuse it." She timed her inside right. And in this presence of mind and self-defense, she was allowed to say with great punch that she was a good gift of God. And she certainly is to this day a very wonderful grandmother, a person who has helped other people to an incredible degree of keeping their own sanity and has restored many people to health. But obviously this one brilliant utterance of the 14-year-old child, she had to forget. We have remembered the story, we recall it. But when I tried to bring it up the other day, she obviously didn't know anymore what she had said. Such a great expression at the height of a critical moment is not there to be preserved. Do you think that she could have gone run around for the next 40 years of her life saying every morning, "I am a good gift of God"? She could not. Ironically, you can say such a thing. They tell the story of a professor who went on an expedition in Asia, and he had to get up every morning at 4 o'clock, and he used to say, "Oh my dear, dear God, why did you create Professor Oetting as such a lazy fellow?" Now, this self-knowledge that he didn't want to get up is perfectly, you see, is not perilous. You can say such a funny thing. But you can't say in seriousness that you are the Messiah. And you can't say in seriousness every minute that you are a good creature of God. Although you are. But this self-consciousness has to go from you in order to protect your growing soul. This is the difference between serious religion and all the quacks in religion, for example, out in Los Angeles, where they love the Amy McPhersons, who once told a friend of mine that she was able to convert 4,000 people a week. Well, any person who can say that she is sure that she converts 4,000 people a week is so shameless and so impudent, and her self-knowledge is so ridiculous that the conversion doesn't amount to anything. In this sense, then, such a sect where the leaders think that they have a definite, secured relation to God Almighty 24 hours a day are perfectly uninteresting to the rest of the world. They are just funny. Anybody who is without shame in matters of supreme importance has no power in history. He cannot achieve anything. He can destroy. But these people are all counted out who know too early or who know too late or want to know forever. I found in an Augustinian sermon the outcry, "Erubisque, erubisque heretici, blush, blush, you sectarian." Because St. Augustine was still absolutely filled with the mantle idea, with the idea that the church was a dress, a garment, containing the union of the children of men. So any sectarian who wanted to dispose of one sentence of the creed, of one power of our faith all the time, so to speak, say, "We must always love our neighbor," or "We must always fear the wrath of God," or "We must do anything always," all such people are sectarians, because they carry a part of the living truth which comes in its good time and say, "This is it." And they handle it after that as a dogmatic, as a mathematical truth. And therefore, St. Augustine cried out, "Blush, blush." and he's despondent because they don't seem to feel the necessary shame. And here again you see the connection between shame, self-knowledge, and the grading of our insides.